place, like what spoke to you about it and how you made the decision to come here?
Yeah. Wow, I could talk a lot about that, you know, just in relation to moving back to this country after being a decade gone and just deciding how I wanted to live after, you know, I spent the 80s basically working in Boston and doing really unsustainable design work for, you know, designing condos and office parks. And my life was on a very different path at that time, and I also, it was a time of growth and Reaganomics that was the beginning, so it was so evident to me that the reasons I had gotten in to that profession were not really what I was going to do. Even when I went to a different firm and I did more public projects, it was develop the hell out of New England. Like, literally, well, let's put a, kind of, you know, put a garage under it. It's a slope site, and we'll call it Oak Run, but there's no oaks there anymore. You know, it was just, like, really earning my money doing something that I didn't want to do. So I left the country and didn't know I was going to be gone for that long, but it changed my whole perspective on how I wanted to live. So when the time came, and it was a very hard decision to move back, I went through a divorce. I don't really want to get into though, but I realized I didn't really belong anymore. I had done what I was there to do, and I had shared a lot and learned a lot. And it was time, even though it was scary as shit, for me to move back to the States. Because I didn't value the things that were coming out. So, and I didn't know how I would live. I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. It's okay.
Outside the system, and I'm not outside, but just knowing that so many of the problems that I saw among incredibly knowledgeable and beautiful people were because of the consumption and mindless consumption in this country and the way we live, and we, you know, the Walmart, you know, you don't know where your shit comes from, you just go buy it. And that whole scary process brought me, you know, it's a long story, but I looked at the Southern Appalachian region because, you know, I'd lived up north, you know, I grew up in Iowa, it was very cold in Boston, you'd get out of the firm and, you know, it'd be dark, and, you know, and I lived in the cool mountains of Guatemala, I didn't have a good time with heat either, and so, you know, really south, the Appalachians area I knew nothing about, it just always interested me. I remember my ex in Boston, and we were driving through to be in a wedding in New Orleans and taking pictures of Appalachia and just deciding, you know, like, first of all, my later years, I mean, I did permaculture courses, and of course I worked with Campesino Permaculture in Guatemala, but I ended up working with folks here in the States doing permaculture. I actually got in on a permaculture workshop in Oaxaca that I didn't understand before I went there. They wanted me to translate, but it was for gringos. It was a shock to me. But anyway, I got to know permaculture teachers, and sometimes they do their workshops overseas. I don't know why they're trying to learn. You know, I did the whole expatriate, you know, go buy cheap land in Costa Rica and take advantage of that was not my, you know, after knowing the realities of Latin America, those distinctions just weren't what I wanted to do. But I did get to know people who were starting communities. One was Earth Haven, Black Mountain. I thought I would, you know, they were like, come on, we're forming this. Actually, a lot of the original people have died that I was part, you know, but or gone, and actually one of them moved away. They aren't part of Earth Haven anymore. But I, for many years when I first came back, I was thinking that maybe that was it, but there was a lot of things about that community that weren't I wanted to grow food and farm and live from that, and as a, you know, like a, not a big scale farm, which obviously this wasn't even farmland, so it was more replicating that you can live from the land and provide food for a community, but the cooperative structure made it very difficult for anybody to have a farm business there, that any kind of, so it wasn't necessarily right. There was a lot of things that weren't right, so it was kind of happenstance that I got a job. The first job I got was in the coal mining region, but I also came to the Berea area the year after that, and during that time I learned about Berea. I worked for Habitat for Humanity the second year and as construction supervisor, basically, which was a good experience. But then I went to work for another builder, an alternative builder, because Habitat works with vinyl siding and trusses and prefab and stuff. And so that part of it wasn't for me, and I wanted to do alternative building and learn more about, you know, the way I built this house is stick building. You know, I upstairs is a full, you know, it's not just trusses and attic that's not useful, right? So I just, like, ended up realizing that Berea was the kind of community that had potential, and it has even more now. There wasn't many people on this creek that, you know, did natural building and knew permaculture. At those days, nobody knew about permaculture in the early, that was the Y2K and, you know, 99, 2000 is about when I got this land. And it was very cheap. It was, there was no road, there was no access, nothing up here. And so it wasn't farmland, so I was able to, you know, get it for basically nothing, because there was no, you know, it wasn't even, I had to clear it. This part had been run with hogs, so it wasn't big things. I had, you know, it was mostly briars and blackberries and cedars and locusts and, but it was something raw, and so it took a lot of camping. You saw it in early years, but it was possible. I was crazy enough. I was in my early 40s then when I moved back, I think. You know, in my 40s and my, even, you know, into my, through my 50s, I felt like I could go for a long time, and I was, for 20 years, I ended up leaving, you know, working outside, like construction and farming, with less than ideal. I don't have a walk-in cooler. I don't have even refrigerator. You know, it's like I don't, less than ideal conditions for the kind of scale farming I was doing. But I made it possible by a lot, maybe very, very inefficient systems, but also didn't take anything. That that was a way that I could be on a piece of land that really spoke to me. And I don't know, that's really didn't answer your question, I think, but it also was important that I could live here and be, not work outside. That was like to live from the land. The early years, my relationship with the land was really exciting because, you know, I could camp. I camped in the forest and lots of different places. That's when I discovered the ramps, and I learned a lot of the local fauna and, you know, the wildflowers and the medicinals. And that, I look back at that, it was very hard. I remember, you always remember, oh my gosh, it was so nice. I made a camp there and I can still see the stones and, you know, it was so romantic, right? And then I just worked all the time just to farm. But it wasn't necessarily. It's never easy. It was hard then. It was so scary because I made a jump that was probably too soon, because I made a jump away from an income before I even had a house. And I camped most of the year on the land, but had to make do. I was lucky to be in Berea where I could get a room for the winter, and I got through Thanksgiving because Thanksgiving stays pretty warm, and camped out in that outdoor kitchen, and then, you know, the tent, I had systems, you know, down comforter in the tent, and put it in the cab of my truck, and, you know, it's dark in the winter, so I'd go to the library and warm up the comforter on my way home and just jump in. It was crazy, But I saved a lot of money that way, and it really made me living outdoors. Like, I live outdoors less, you know. Of course, I have everything open, but it's a lot different when you actually live in the elements most of the year, because you really, really learn your sight. Not just the forest, which is lovely. I mean, most of the land is forested, and it's such a blessing to have spring water, that the whole watershed up there is protected in that, you know, I own it. So that, it's priceless. And so I don't want to leave that, but I realize I cannot physically sustain what I've done the last 20 years. I mean, I changed my diet so I have less back problems and stuff, but I am, like, seeing that, you know, it's not like the 60s. 60s isn't that old. In old times it wasn't, but it does make me think, yes, I can't push my body to the limit all the time, and so I have to find another way. So, and also, I really like the experiments that I've always wanted to do, like the rice paddy that I slowly finally got to grow rice and just try different things. So many things, like finish this house. I mean, the house has never been finished. Those kinds of things are things that just got pushed aside because I had to just, it was feeling like I was in a crank in an economic system that makes it very hard to choose this. And I think the reason that I'm able to, people always say, well, I can't believe you can live off of this. And it is about needs. Like, the relationship to the land has to be really, really tight when you, like, I've, you know, like the chickweed we were talking about, or all the edibles that just give to me naturally are very important to me, because I may eat just, I mean, it's kind of funny how I ate this last year, because I was in financial, you know, it's like I just barely made it, but I ate just kind of like we did in Guatemala, beans. I did cornbread, not tortillas, but I just ate what I had. And I mean, I hate shopping anyway, so I probably wouldn't have chosen that. But there was not a choice to go to a grocery store for those kinds of things if you don't have money. And that's just totally connects me to the way the people I learned from lived for so long. I mean, you just have to take responsibility for your resources, everything. You can't just go buy it and expect slave labor somewhere else and exploitation to give you those resources.
Yeah. Something you said on the podcast really struck me about that one of the reasons you chose to be this kind of farmer here is to be in solidarity with the sort of the peasants around the world. And I never heard you say that, and I thought that was really beautiful.
But yeah, I feel like solidarity is a funny thing, and it almost feels like it's a point of privilege to even say that. You know, what I mean is that it keeps reminding me that the Mother Earth gives, but not over, like, gives what we need, but not for selfish consumption. And that kind of solidarity is really what I meant, because I don't feel that I could compare myself even with the choices I made here, because I have privilege of living in this country no matter what. And because so many of my friends who are people of color don't even have that in this country, it's become so evident that I feel like that kind of the solidarity has to go farther than just me, like, choosing to live like this. It has to mean me actively supporting. And I really attained to do that. Unfortunately, last year I had to cancel all my permaculture workshops, but I made it a goal to get more people of color than just one or two, because in the early years, I didn't even have that. But last the permaculture workshop in September of 2019, it was about a third African American. We had a New Zealand native. We had, you know, people of Latin American heritage and Asian. It was mostly African American heritage because of the connections I had made, and because there's been so many wonderful organizations that have helped me, and because of there's a woman, Leah Penniman, who wrote a book that really inspired me, Soul Fire Farm. So it inspired people. Like, there's a Black Dirt, Friends near D.C., but there's this Black Soil Collective here now in Kentucky. And so just being able to offer scholarships, that's my goal. For people who really, really are determined to do it but don't have another way. I did it with work trades, with friends who, you know, helped me with the workshop ahead of time, just to try to get that. Because when I say, you know, that to me is solidarity when it becomes more than tokenism, where you have to talk the white talk, or because we were able to, it was a challenge because we had some people be uncomfortable with us spending time talking about how hard it is to get approval for a kitchen or a facility when you are an African American, or just buying things. That reality here today in 2021, you know. So that to me is a way that we're going to change the way we live in. I'm sorry.
No, it's okay.
You know, the way we can change the way we live on this earth has to be together with other people where we are. And so my solidarity with people in Latin America has to be what I do here with people who have been pushed out of that opportunity.
Reimagining community. Okay. I'm sorry, I'm just like a little emotional too. Okay. So I wanna talk. I think that I'm really glad that you shared all of that you just spoke. I think it's really important. I wanna talk a little bit about, like, how, and maybe it's too abstract, but just like how long you've been here, how you feel that the land has changed you, and that, like, being in this environment has changed you in time. And then I think, like, I want to talk a little bit at the end just about how you see the future, and how the reimagining of community and the rebuilding food webs and this, you know, and rebuilding our soil could help to save the
I may not be able to remember all this, so you'll have to push it in.
You.
Why don't we start with the first thing?
How has your relationship to the land changed over time, and how has the land changed you?
Well, I think when I'm honest, I see that my upbringing and my way of being that I learned, when we joked about it earlier, has kind of overlain my relationship with the land, because it's not that I've tried to attain a lot of money, but I've chosen this. I've been persistent that I'm not going to work out, you know, in the system outside of this. But it has made me, brought out the workaholic that's always been there, because you kind of have to survive. And, you know, I saw that in Latin America too. I mean, this is the reality of living from the land. But because I've done it without that community system, I've did it with apprentices, and that was a very important thing woofing and then apprentices that came from that. That was important, but it's not the same thing as a structure that's consistent with a family and a community. So those changes that happened for me with the land were sometimes very intentional as I watched things, and they're permaculture type things. I watched things grow and understand them from the basis of productivity and what I wanted to attain. And I learned from a lot of, it's lovely to, like I was saying earlier, to really begin to have an intimate relationship with the land, know just where the sun's going to be and how it, and how the cycles of the season affect, you know. I think about, you know, it's a saying, but like when the oak leaves get the size of squirrel feet, I know, like, it doesn't mean the date when I start planting the corn. It's like understanding that Mother Earth tells me so many things. I remember when I moved into, this isn't really the land, but I lived in here without that wood stove, and I built this as passive solar to the south. And I've covered it with tile now, but I've tracked the low southern sun of the winter on that back wall, heating up the earthen floor, the mass of the back wall that was just buried, and understanding just how that kept me warm without even that. I mean, it wasn't real warm, but the first winter I had nothing. I was on, you know, I was still building this, and so I didn't have anything. I just had a makeshift thing in here. And so I realized just how, when you work with, you know, what the earth gives you, it just, that learning is priceless. And the stars, for example, they the changes, you know, pretty soon I won't see Orion at all at night, you know, those kinds of things, where a lot of the stars are. That's a lovely thing. That, you know, being outdoors, like, and camping and all of this, the times hearing the coyotes pretty, like, right there, you know, all of those things really, really were important to the frog. I mean, you know, I joked about the wood frogs and, you know, their orgy, but just having that relationship and just yelling at them, it's like, would you shut up? It's like, please. I can't take it anymore. The party's over. Go to bed. tell me what else. I was like, what else? It's so easy for me to get off track.
No, it's okay. It's kind of a loose track. So I guess just last questions about, like, what role you see in this sort of small-scale agriculture as a way of healing the planet?
Mm.
And where you're at, like, in terms of, like, your optimism and hope for the future?
Yeah, I think that Clear Creek here, south of Berea especially, has given me a lot of hope as communities have built up and we help each other. We have relations that I need to tune into more, that it's hard from my upbringing to ask for help. I feel like some of the things you participated in, like the corn harvest party, have been an intentional thing, but I still feel like, oh, I can't ask them, you know. It's like I really want to do that more, and I can see the benefits of it. At the same time, not having a family unit and now juggling consulting and teaching more and not being able to really accept apprentices when I'm not going to be here so much of the time, I have such a hard time with asking for help. But that really is the importance of a community, because we can't do, like, I look at things that I need to care for, and I can only do so much, and it's hard to see that, and it's less joyful when it's overwhelming. At the same time, I can't, you know, I can't see leaving it, right? So it's like I want to find a way to sustain more, for more people to be able to sustain themselves here. And that's been a real challenge to figure out how to do that, because I've chosen such a tiny, like, in it, there's no piece of, there was no fertility at all up here. So every bit of land to grow crops for food had to be improved because it was so eroded. So it really doesn't support very many people. I've made it support a lot more because, you know, I cleared enough land to do that, but it was more just soil improvement that it's been slow, but it's been surprisingly fast to people because of the organic matter buildup. It's just been, so it's concentrated, but the site doesn't allow for a lot of, you know, people to have their houses. And I don't even, you know, I can't house people all year round, or I can't afford to build something for somebody to be here all year round. And so that has been, like, how to do that has been really tough, you know. And legally, like, just having somebody else wanting to build, like, how to do that too. So, remind me of the question again, because
I want you to talk a little bit about where you're at in terms of optimism and hope for the future. I mean, the future, like, the, you know, of our species, of the planet, yeah. Climate. With the climate change, climate crisis, and
yeah, I mean, it is important to have optimism because it's not going to be easy. Obviously, there's going to be a lot of difficulty with that, but I also feel like there's so much more than there was 20 some years ago when I started here, and moved back in culture shock. It was, even here in Berea, there wasn't that much of people really, really trying to walk that path and finding a way. Learning, people know what permaculture is. Not that permaculture itself is the only, you know, answer, but there's a lot of, in the principles of permaculture that really help us follow that path. And so the fact that people are trying to live closer to the earth and communities are forming around that just gives me a ton of hope. And when I look at Clear Creek, I mentioned earlier just how many people there are on this creek. Then it was only when I first started here, there was myself and another couple that were kind of trying to live. They were trying to live off-grid too, and there was really so few people. So many people have moved here, and, you know, the local people, which were my primary relationship, and that's always been a really good thing for me to have that bridge, because there's the interest, not everybody. And in this very divisive time, to have built those relationships, because I was the only one, to have built that bridge to people who think I'm, you know, an outsider and weird and doing weird things, but also having come from a rural background, I feel like I was able to really build relationships, and they truly have been interested and brought their kids up and, you know, say I want to show them this. And so those relationships too, it actually has become more challenging on Clear Creek, and also, you know, just really inspiring because of divisiveness, and because there has been so many people move here who weren't from here, and but people that had land here lost their connection to the land. Not all of them, but I feel like it is hard because, you know, there's neither are better or worse. It's just a hard, it's like the racial divide that I see. It's something we have to understand each other on. And when you're no longer living for the land, you can't resent people who work hard. There are people who maybe have more than you did to start with. It's possible, but there's also choices that we make. And when people see me working really hard, and realize that I'm not privileged, then they look at me differently and they can't make the stereotypes that they make of people when they don't get to know them. So that's been important to me, because it's easy to avoid. There's a neighbor of mine who just had a fire, and I was like, we need to organize a work party. And I, two people I know who are new on the creek came down by at the same time, and they felt uncomfortable. They just, like, the conversation ended, and they're like, we're so sorry, and they just drove off. And it is difficult because the relationships haven't been built, and I don't necessarily like this guy. We've had our differences, but I don't wish the worst for him. And I also, like, the first time I used a corn sheller, I went to his hand corn sheller, and, you know, he makes fun of me sometimes, but I don't want to see him lose everything because, you know, he had a fire in his old electricity in his house. But that's a place where we have to bring many different types together, because that's what this country, especially, it's plus and it's minus, and I've really seen it since I've been in rural Kentucky. And I just feel so, you know, it's such a relief to have Berea, and it's very, there's a lot of really wonderful things about living in a progressive small town, because I left, you know, when I went to college, I left rural America and didn't ever think I would go back because of the small-mindedness. And then I didn't want to be a parasite in the city after learning, like, thinking I was making this excursion to Latin America. And after a decade there, I realized that I needed to change that, because rural people of my and rural people changed my life. I mean, I'm not going to idealize them. There's a lot of crazy shit too, you know, but they made me look, they didn't try necessarily, but I started to look at things a lot differently in the way I lived.
Elijah, do you think are there other questions that you think
we
need to cover?
So one of the things that you haven't even done, but one of the things that I learned from Don Gavino in Guatemala is how to select corn seeds to breed corn. You know, the Mayans and the Aztecs really are the ones that took teosinte, which was the size of a wheat, and made it into corn. Beautiful corn. And so I took corn that I got in eastern Kentucky that was half this size, and made it into something I could be proud of. So this has been my baby, is corn. The three sisters and corn. And that's really, that's been my biggest relationship to the land. I'm so glad that because you've been part of that several times now, like as far as the harvest of the corn. And right now it's just a big rye cover crop out there. But, you know, when the three sisters are planted and harvested, it always takes me back to that connection. And it's a connection to Guatemala, but it's also a connection to this land, because the native people here, this is what they sustain themselves on, you know, is the beans and the corn. And I guess it's especially important to me. I just feel like I was gifted with knowledge, and here I come from Iowa in a farm that represents the exact opposite of what's been done with our native grain, is GMO corn. And it saddens me to see the industrialization, and just like, to go through the deserts, it's not a desert, but it feels like a desert, because everything is like, even the corn is all exactly the same height, because it's all the same genetics. It's a stack of cards just waiting to fall. And my brother would come here and he'd say, like, how do you combine that? Because it's really tall. And like, well, you know, it's human food. And actually, I get more propounded than at that time. I remember when he said that, than they got per bushel of GMO corn that was being fed to animals that really shouldn't eat it because it makes them sick. But that's another story. But saving corn is hard because of its, like, outbreeding. And one of the things, you know, it can't be inbred because then it gets genetically weak. But I'm so blessed to be surrounded by forest and Daniel Boone National Forest that the pollen from the GMO corn, the silage corn down, like, there's a guy down the creek, you know, that grows it. It can't get up here. But in Iowa, it can travel for miles. And so the crossing of organic corn is almost, you know, it's a sad thing right now. We really have contaminated corn, but we can save it. That's a big one for me. It's hard to be optimistic when you look at the scale, but if petroleum cannot be sustained, then that system can't. And you know, people probably won't eat that kind of meat anymore anyway when they can't do it, and they'll have to rely more on plants. So it's possible we can save some and get it back to what it should be. I'm getting off track.
No, you're good. It's really just, it was great. And I think that's all, like, I didn't really have a plan, so we've met all my expectations. But if there's anything else that you would like to say, this part, and then we can go plant.
What are your goals with this? I mean, I feel like I've just, every time you've asked me a question, I just do.
So
like,
I want to do
stream of consciousness.
Yeah, how I am. So I appreciate that. Like, I mean, I'm like a very stream of consciousness kind of writer in person. But I mean, if you would like, I mean, so we're just doing. We talked about this in the car, but it's like, I don't know if I want to go into, like, gender and, like, sexual orientation and things like that, because I've never asked you if you identify as a woman, but the project...
Yes, I do, okay, even good. Though I... Yeah, it's a funny because I get that a lot because people are like, you know, she must be gay at least, and I'm like, I guess it might have been easier if I was... But I'm actually not. I thought about it. I actually have tried it even in Boston. Remember, I was like, it just didn't do it for me. Yeah. So I guess not. You know, I believe there's a spectrum.
Yeah, yeah.
Always. Yeah. And so just because I'm not girly girl doesn't mean that, I don't know. It's so funny.
I don't want to assume that, like, people's gender identity. So, like, the project is...
It's so funny that, like, you thought that maybe...
Not like me. I don't know. I guess I shouldn't assume anymore. But like, the project is, like, focused on women farming sustainably. So if you want to talk about... If you have thoughts about how being a woman in particular has made this... your journey?
Well, I mentioned earlier that in relationships for me, or heterosexual relationships especially, it hit, because that's what I am, it's been challenging because I wasn't going to wait for somebody at 40. You know, I came back here to this country after having gone through relationships and tried that here in my 40s, and then 50s, even. But it was hard because I went ahead and did what I wanted to do. So it has to be an alternative. When you get my age, it's not even that important anymore, except to have a community. So when it was me going ahead with what I wanted to do, it makes it hard for anybody to come in and, like, oh, she built this house, and that's, you know, she built the farm. I mean, it's Susanna's farm.
Yeah.
And that's hard. And I think it's, like I said before, it's probably even harder for a male.
Yeah.
Because of our socialization. Or a lot of males. I'm not going to speak for everybody. But, you know, so that really was probably the hardest thing for me, is that didn't. You know, that kind of partnership did not work out for me.
Yeah.
and maybe even, you know, up through, I guess it's now been 8 years ago, I was still trying that. And so then I was so busy with apprenticeships and thinking that maybe, you know, that I would find a way through there, and then realizing that I really did need to teach more. It's hard for me to find the transition without help, without a direct community. It's having a community, a wider community is important, but also having a land, some kind of fabric of a family unit, mm-hmm. whatever that is, mm-hmm. like whatever the traditional family unit or a unit of communities. And having experimented with the I lived in a cooperative house in Boston, which isn't quite the same, but knowing people that have had experiences, and like I mentioned, Earth Haven and Asheville or Black Mountain, it is challenging because we aren't raised that way. I mean, when there's four of us that bought land out here, you know, Sky bought from one of the original ones, but nobody else for the longest time had anything until Josh sold that piece. And so I thought that was going to be it, you know, because there's no way any of us could have bought 100. It was 98 acres, so we each had a quarter of it. We didn't co-own it, which I looked at it from my experience and seeing what happened at Earth Haven, and choosing to farm, and how people did it in rural farming communities, that I knew that it would be difficult, especially as a business, which it had to be, because you have to have some money, right? So I just decided that was it was like Amish. We used to call it an Amish-like community because you help each other. But even the Amish now aren't being that, you know, barn raisings and stuff. But like I said before, I have learned to ask more, but there's a limit to that. And I feel like I got the roof on that granary. Apprentices helped me a bit, but I had a barn raising with that kind of. And at the house, I had a few work parties, just like there's no way to do a roof by yourself to get the sheet metal up there. So those things really are the reason I'm here, even without a family, you know, because a lot of couples will build, you know, yeah. by themselves. You have to have at least two people for some things. You can do a lot building by yourself. It's very inefficient. And I built a lot I sided the whole place in the winter, and it's so slow because you get up the ladder, you make a cot wrong, you have to get down. And in early years, I had to run the generator. I was like, dang, I gotta start the generator again. So there's a lot of inefficiency, and it's very slow to do it by yourself. But, you know, the pioneers, they... mostly men, you know, they would do it. So proving that I could as a woman was pretty funny, but it's not necessarily why I did it. I think that is a challenge as a woman here. I mean, I think the other side of that is a lot of women farmers I know are married, and they don't necessarily... they aren't the decision makers often. I see that a lot, even with people I wouldn't expect it. If a lot of things get, you know, and it's no fault of either one, because I see like couples, like friends of mine right here, where I'm like, Carrie, you know how to do that, but defer, like, okay, like defer that, like, oh, you know, he's more efficient at it. Well, that's because he's practiced at it, because it's always relied, you know, he's the one with a hammer, because that's the way you're socialized. But it's not rocket science. That's why I had women's builds with Habitat, because, you know, when volunteers would come, and this is way off track, but when volunteers would come and they would be mixed male and female, I would say, would you show her how to hang a door? And I'd come back, and she'd be standing there watching him put it in. And I'm like, no, that's not how you show. Let me show you how you, like, you know, you actually put the shim in here, so you get the experience of it. And he's like, yeah, I thought you wanted to get it in. So, yeah, those social things are hard. And I think a lot of women just do defer so much. And it's self-confidence that comes over time with just taking that challenge and just having to. When there's no choice, you just do it. And you may not be the most efficient. There's a lot of... I'm the jack of all trades, so I'm slower at things. Like, when I haven't been building for a while, I'm like, oh, gosh. You know, it's like... Because it's not what I've been doing. Like, so I'm slower at things. But, you know, you just be accepting. You know, I'm not spending money on labor. All right. Well, that was I'm sure that was not at all what you expected to do.
No, that's great. That is. I mean, I really just went I think I could have just said, like, yeah, so just talk for